This is The Guardian.
Hello, Pod fans. Max here. Just a heads up, there is some offensive and discriminatory language in today's show. Here it is. Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Today we're doing a special on the experiences of the LGBTQ plus community in all aspects of the game, whether it's as a match-going fan, just watching in the pub, online or playing at grassroots. It's a very simple question. What is it like? And has football shaped the timing or indeed the decision of people to come out at all? Have people's experiences changed over the years? Do campaigns like the Rainbow Laces make a difference? Do we put too much emphasis on players coming out? And how do we balance the good that's being done with a World Cup about to take place in a country where homosexuality is illegal? And perhaps most importantly, what is the best way people listening to this help make the game as inclusive as possible? We're really grateful that so many of you have contributed your stories to today's pod. We're going to use them as a way of discussing the issues that matter most to you. This is The Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hi, Max. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. From Proud Lily White and Kick It Out, Chris Powross, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, very good. A pod debut for Rishi Madlani from Fox's Pride and Pride in Football. Hey, Rishi.
Hey, pleasure to be on.
Yeah, you said you enjoyed the pod, but now you're sort of seeing behind the scenes. By the end, you might have a very different view of things. And Pod Galactico, Nikki Bandini, came out as transgender in 2019. Hey, Nikki.
Morning.
I guess I'll probably start on your personal experiences. I mean, Chris, we've had you on talking about these things a lot. Had you on the radio all the time talking about these things, but never really asked you about your story. I don't know if that is that rude of me never to ask you that question, or is it just sort of
not at all, Max? Because you know what, when you've got a few seconds on the radio to talk about a thing, you're not really going to go, "Oh right, so tell me your life story." So I'm all right with that. I'm totally all right with that.
Well, tell me your life story, Chris. Here we are.
I won't go into too much detail because we will be here all day, obviously, because I'm quite old. But look, I've been a football fan. I've been a Spurs fan all my life. And I first went to White Hart Lane when I was six. And that feeling of like walking up the steps, because you always walk up the steps at White Hart Lane, and seeing the grass and all of those people who had the same love for the football team that I had. And just that real feeling of like the collective kind of energy, the collective hope before a game, sometimes the collective despair at the end of it. But, you know, just that thing where you stand up all together as the ball's flying through the air. There's nothing like it. And I've always loved it. However, around the sort of the time of my political awakening, I suppose, and my sort of late teens, early 20s, my early 20s is when I came out, I slightly fell out of love with the game. Because I kind of like, I was just sort of thinking, how does it fit with how I fit? How does football in its current state fit with how I feel about the world? And how do I reconcile those two things? And I found it quite difficult, you know, I was like a raging lesbian feminist, you know, and it was just like, it doesn't work, right? However, I'd always promised the sort of six-year-old me, that six-year-old little girl, that when I grew up and got a job, I'd get a season ticket. So I did. And so I got a season ticket in the mid-90s at White Hart Lane. So let me tell you, in those days, I literally went to the ticket office and said, "Hello, can I have a season ticket?" And they said, "Sure, where would you like to sit?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't mind. I just don't want to sit behind the goal." So for those of you who know White Hart Lane, in the East Stand, and I didn't want to be in the West Stand because those are the posh seats, in the East Stand, there were two big white pillars. And for 20 years, I sat about eight rows behind that and didn't see the, and I never saw the 18-yard line. I spent the time sort of with my head bobbing from side to side.
To be fair, in the 90s, Chris, probably not too bad as a Spurs fan.
Well, exactly. Like the less you could see, the better, frankly. And actually, in that time, I kind of, for me personally, I sort of like, well, this is my house. And so there was no way I was going to kind of stand for any kind of abuse, discrimination, etc. But because you know what it's like when you've got a season ticket, you get to know all the people around you. From a season ticket holder perspective, you know, like it genuinely was a lovely place to be. It was weird because you hung out with people that you wouldn't hang out with ordinarily. And some of them, I didn't know their names. And that's weird as well, because it's like 15 years later, it's a little bit embarrassing to say, what was your name again? So, you know, lots of kind of, you know, other ways of addressing people. From a sort of an LGBTQ plus fan perspective, the thing I found really difficult was away games. And me and my late wife, I can't remember where we were. It might have been the Hawthorns in the early 2000s, where we actually sort of had a conversation and said, should we just wear headphones so we don't have to listen to all of this? And that was from our fans, as well as whatever abuse we were getting from the opposition, you know, from the opposition. And that was all sorts, but, you know, including, you know, homophobia. So, you know, but I mean, that's, to be honest, you know, that's why we started the Proud Lilywhites. Because actually I was just like, look, football's for us too. And if there are people out there, LGBTQ plus fans, who, you know, think about how I described that feeling of being a football fan at the beginning. You don't want to deny that to anybody. And so people who have got the opportunity to go to a live football match, you know, the thought of not going because you're fearful or worried about the experience that you might have, etc. Like, that's no place for football, no way for football to operate. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why we set up the Proud Lilywhites.
So, Chris, was the abuse you were hearing just general homophobic abuse, or was being directed specifically at you?
Both. So stuff that you get either, you know, stuff at, that's aimed at footballers. And actually, the interesting thing about that, of course, is that it's actually about gender, not about sexual orientation, the stuff that gets levelled at footballers. Because if football is for men, then it's for real men, not those who don't fit some macho stereotypes. And that's why it becomes hard for women too. And it's complicated as a lesbian, because you can be one of the lads. But if it means enabling misogyny or being exclusionary, I'm not up for it. But also, you know, like, if you're a fat old dyke, excuse my language, quoting some of the things I might have heard in the past, then actually you get a little bit of that as well.
Rishi, I wonder what your experiences were growing up, and sort of how football affected coming out and the link between your sexuality and the game.
Absolutely, I'm happy to go into that. So my family are all East African Asians. So in the 70s, the Indians were thrown out by Idi Amin, and a large chunk of the Indian community settled in Leicester. So my family were always split between London and Leicester, and Leicester has always been sort of a home. We spent our summers there. And I always count myself lucky, because some of my cousins end up being supporting small teams like Liverpool, Manchester United, that I've never really heard of. And luckily for me, I got taken along by my cousins, who were partly less into football, actually, and that was why they were Leicester City fans, because back then it wasn't particularly great. And they took me along to my first game. And as someone who spent a lot of time there, felt very much at home. For those of you who don't know it, Leicester's an ethnic majority city. It's a very large Indian, South Asian, but now very mixed population there. But it's very integrated, to the point where, you know, the little old lady next to me will ask me for specific Indian recipes that I can never cook or never try and cook. And when I think of this little old white lady cooking tokra at home, or something that I would never even dream of trying to cook, when my mother has sent her recipe immediately, I was like, she's like, this is urgent, I need to make sure this lady can make this. So it's been part of that community piece of me. Football's always been an escape for me. I have a very annoyingly busy job in climate change, because it's not being sold anytime soon, and a bit of dabbling in politics as a local councillor. So, you know, football's meant to be my escape from the madness. And unfortunately, I'm not one of these people who can stand by and watch things that are not perfect or not good, you know, and we will stand up. I first met Chris at a Stonewall leadership program, come up to a decade ago, Chris. It's kind of terrifying. And she set up Proud Lilywhites. And I was sort of like, hang on, if Spurs can do this, we can do this too. So connected up with other Leicester fans. And, you know, given I'm here as both Pride and Football and for Sports Pride, there were 5-6 groups that all formed around the same time, about 2013. 9 years later, I can't believe it. You know, the proliferation, we've got now over 50 groups, 2 new groups formed last week alone, Leicester Orient and Accrington Stanley. Welcome and warm welcome to them. If you're fans or allies, please join them. And our movement has grown and grown. Now, the boy who used to go along, sometimes away games by myself as a young teenager, as a one brown away fan, as well as gay, stood in the stands, could not ever believe where we are now today, where in the East Stand, I'm surrounded by Fox Pride members, allies, you know, the season ticket holders around me, not only are like pay passing interest, they want to take our badges, they wear Fox's Pride merchandise, their children wear Fox's Pride merchandise because they really want to support and show their support. And I can't even, I pinch myself for how much we've changed. Now, it's not all perfect, and I think that's why we're having this pod today and this discussion today. There are still problems, but actually we've also got to recognise how far we've come, and I almost can't believe how far we've come sometimes, but at the same time very aware of how much further we have to go.
Nikki, I wonder if being a football fan and working in football meant it took you longer to come out than perhaps it would have done.
Yeah, no, of course it did. Of course it did. I think absolutely. For me, when I was wrestling with, and by the way, it's kind of, when it comes to work, it's the public part of coming out, because sorry to break it to everyone here, but I might have told some people in my private life before I was talking about that publicly. And yeah, of course it did. It made things much more difficult. I think for a long time, I thought that it was not possible with the work I do. I think I sincerely thought about changing career before coming out. That was something I thought about, is whether or not I'd have to just try and find a different career to move into, and then that might be more possible, make a fresh start in some way. I really struggled for finding role models within football for the journey that I was on. I think once I came out, I maybe even learned of a few people who I didn't know about before who might have been good role models. Funnily enough, there were some people sort of not doing exactly what I was doing, but who have trod different paths. There are other journalists in different sports in different countries who have trod a similar path. But, you know, there have also been some examples of people who, gosh, this is, we're going straight into some heavy stuff. But, there was one journalist in the United States, Christine Daniels, who came out and transitioned very publicly. I don't know Christine. It's before I have had a chance to meet them, and I don't want to speak of their story because I don't know the truths and ins and outs of their stories, but I know that they took their own life. And that was something that, just being honest about how it affected me personally, was very, very heavy. You know, that was something that I thought, gosh, that's only reaffirming in my head. And again, I feel quite disrespectful talking about it because it's I don't know if that's what had anything to do with that in the pressures they were under. But how you read a story, how you hear it, how you feel it personally, and on my end, reaffirmed the worst things I thought, that this was not a world that you could step into and be out in. And yes, it's not an easy question to come straight in on that, because to be honest, but yes, it was a very hard one.
No. I'm sorry. I'm sort of really aware that they're very sensitive issues. And like, if I ask anything that mm-hmm. is sort of stupid, I mean, I obviously ask lots of stupid questions. You know that already, Nikki. But like, if I ask anything that isn't sort of appropriate, just do say. Because I've been really conscious that you haven't really talked about it. I haven't really, you wrote that article, obviously, when you came out, you did the video, but then it's kind of right. I just want to, I write about football, I talk about football, the rest of it should be irrelevant. Obviously that's a really conscious decision that you have made, almost to the point where I was slightly nervous about asking you to do this pod,
You were very respectful about it, Max. Actually, I have to say, I think, the vast majority of people that I work with, not all, but the vast majority of people I work with have been, and I think certainly you have been, everyone on Football Weekly has been. I was very deliberate when I came out that I was going to tell my story in that article that I wrote. And I came on Football Weekly and said, spoke about it for a few minutes. And I did a very short video, which I now hate looking back on, because I think I look exhausted and smashed in like a broken way, not in a drunk way, in a broken way. And probably it's because that's how I was, to be honest. Honestly, this is so difficult to talk about, because I can't talk about it without framing it in the way that I already have. Like I was really sort of weighed on by the things that I'd sort of been living within my head, and this sort of feeling I had from learning about Christine's story was, this was someone who was under extraordinary pressure. This was someone who was under sort of such an intense spotlight the whole time. And I didn't want that. I turned down so many interview requests in the days after I came out. And that was very deliberate. I felt like I wanted to protect myself. And I also felt like, I mean, there was another part to it as well, which was I felt like I didn't have more things to say. I felt like as soon as you sort of make that sort of very public step, I guess, people suddenly think that you're an authority on all things trans and an authority on what it means to be a transgender woman working in sport. And the fact is, at that moment in time, I hadn't worked in sport in an out way. I hadn't dealt with that part of my journey at all. So I didn't have anything else to say. What else could I have said at that point that would have been relevant? So I thought the best thing to do was to button my lip and to look after myself. And that's what I did for a couple of years. And I honestly do feel, not that I'm suddenly going to make this sort of 180 on it, but like I do feel like maybe now I'm able to say things more because I've lived more life since then. You know, it is 3 years since I made that decision and wrote that article. And decision's a horrible way of framing that. There was no decision made at the point where I got to. It was an inevitability that you sort of had to confront one way or the other. 3 years have passed. I have more life experience. I have more things I can say. So I'm in a very different place now anyway to where I was when I wrote the article.
It's great to hear. And did you feel like, I remember you sort of emailed us, like I presume sort of a big selection of people you work with to say this news, and it must have been incredibly stressful to sort of press send on that email. And I wonder if, were you surprised either way on how it was received, like straight away and over the last 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, I was certainly surprised by some of the initial reaction. God, there's so many layers to the reaction to it, right? Because, you know, the very first people I spoke to within journalism were my immediate editors, right? So I hope you won't mind me naming names, but at The Guardian, the first person I spoke to was Marcus Christensen. And Marcus Christensen is a lovely editor, a lovely person, a great human being. You know, it was a virtual communication at first, but I felt like, you know, a virtual arm around me looking after me and not, no worries from him at all. Like I felt like I was supported very, 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 very well by Marcus. And immediately the conversation was, how do you want to do this? How do you want to talk about this? I felt like, yeah, the vast majority of responses I got from colleagues were really warm, positive. Not all, to be totally truthful with you, not all, but the vast majority. And then the public part of it was astonishing. I mean, I have a very good friend who came and looked after me the day that everything went public. A friend from school came and took my phone off me, basically. And we like went down and sat. I think it's very common knowledge now on the podcast. I'm not revealing anything. I live in Brighton, and we went and sat on the beach in Brighton, and I wasn't allowed to look at it for a long time. And then, of course, when I looked at it, there was God knows how many thousands of responses and some surprisingly famous people who I'm sure have immediately forgotten who I am and don't know who I am, who had responded to it. But most of it, you know, really the overwhelming amount of that public response that I saw anyway was positive. I didn't see much negativity at all. And I can't even fathom that, to be honest with you, because there's all sorts of negativity on the internet when it comes to LGBTQ plus people. That's not any secret, and I've seen plenty of it in time since, but on the day, I have to say, maybe the algorithms just played a trick on me, but I felt like I saw much more positive than not.
Well, it's great to hear your stories. I'm sort of delighted, Nikki, that you're sort of happy to talk about it, and it's great to hear how positive it has been. We're gonna move on to part two, where we're gonna hear from lots of listeners who've got involved and got in touch about lots of parts of how the LGBTQ plus community experience football at the moment. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We are still on tour. Yeah, we are. It never ends. I never stop tweeting about it until we fill the Hackney Empire. Nikki, you're coming to Hackney Empire on the 8th of July, along with Troy Townsend, Jonathan Wilson, me and Barry. On Saturday, Ellis James, Barney Ronay and Sid Lowe join me and Baz, and Philippe Auclair and Jonathan Wilson will be with us in Glasgow on the 13th of July. There is merch available. I didn't design the half and half Rushton Glendening scarf, but you can buy it. David Squires t-shirts and mugs, which are brilliant. Go to myticket.co.uk. And we are going to live stream the Saturday show from the Hackney Empire. So that one with Ellis, Barney and Sid. It's available for a week afterwards. So a bit like the live online shows we did during lockdown. Go to the same place, myticket.co.uk. It is cheaper. But if you live in and around Hackney, no excuses. You can't just stay at home. You have to come and watch it. We had loads of people get in touch about their experiences. The most common ones were actually about like chanting that people hear, actually amateur football and what they hear on the pitch in amateur football. I'm going to read a couple of examples. Some of the language isn't pleasant, but isn't something that a match-going fan won't have heard. I'm sure of it. Tony said, as a closeted gay man fighting with my sexuality in the early 2000s, the patterns of behaviour in football matches and from family and friends around me definitely attributed to me taking longer to come to terms with my sexuality and the issues that followed, PTSD of burying true feelings in for so long, etc. Being closeted and young at football matches is a strange experience as you're denying your true self and getting it validated by the language and actions you see around you. The pressures to act straight and blend in were constant stress, but only something I realised on self-reflection once I stopped going to football matches and came to terms with my sexuality. The macho culture of football means you hear discrimination in all forms in most matches you go to. This could be just small comments, a inverted commas, harmless joke, or something bigger and more threatening to any vulnerable groups. The people I went to the matches with are some of the most lovely, down-to-earth, selfless people you could meet, but their lack of experience with more diverse groups tends to ensure that anything beyond their own social group and perspective is hard to understand. Andy wrote, I grew up as a Man City fan. I now manage the Millwall Pride LGBT team. One of the most awkward experiences of my life was thousands of City fans chanting, O'Shea takes it up the arse at Old Trafford while I was stood next to my dad. 2-1 win that day. Thank you, Benjani. He says, I had come out a few weeks earlier. I didn't know how to react, so I just tried to laugh about it while internally feeling very conflicted. We've talked about fan behaviour in grounds a lot on Football Weekly. I wonder, have you noticed a change, Chris?
I think it's hard to say because talking about sort of the trajectory of sort of more LGBTQ plus fan activism, because I think the last season, you know, since the stadium were closed for lockdown, has resulted in some really kind of some kind of like fan behavior, in inverted commas. Behavior sounds weird because it sounds like we're talking about kids, right? That's been quite full on. I don't know if it's people are more angry, like really excited about being back at football just because of, you know, the sort of the political climate, you know, with more, you know, more populism or whatever. And that's the one place you get to, you know, because I think the thing about football fans is that what you've got is you've got sort of lots of fans who have been there a long time, and you know, sort of that could be the outlet. But you've also got loads of fans who are just, you know, who have got opportunities to go to games. So like at Spurs, we've got a much bigger stadium now, so you've got a much more diverse fan base in terms of gender, ethnicity, and I'm assuming sexual orientation and gender identity, but you don't know, right? The thing I'm really proud of, to build on something that Rishi said earlier, is, you know, we've got that massive rainbow flag up in the corner at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And I can't tell you how many messages we get from people saying, I didn't, you know, I used to be a Spurs fan when I was a kid, but I kind of got a ticket and came to a game because I saw your flag, or have joined the Proud Lily Whites and have met up with others and have come back to football in a much more kind of active, match-going way because the Proud Lily Whites exists, you know. And I talk about fan activism, you know, we talked about it on the pod already in terms of the CPS changing the how they deal with a certain chant that gets levelled often when Chelsea are playing or Chelsea loanees are playing. And, you know, Lee, who's my co-chair, I think we've talked about this before, he didn't go to football for 6 years because of that chant. He missed saying goodbye to White Hart Lane. You know, and that's something he really holds in him, because as a football fan, that stuff matters to us, right? It matters, like, you've got this kind of grand old stadium that's been there for, like, more than 100 years and you miss it because of homophobia, you know. And he's back, he's got a season ticket now, but that's why what we're doing is really important. And are things worse now? I mean, I you know, these things go in ups and downs anyway, and I don't, you know, we can't necessarily separate it from a wider context.
Rishi, what should fans do? I think it's such a, I speak as someone who's, I don't think, right, when I was 10, like, calling someone gay was I definitely did it, right? I can't say I didn't do it when I was 10 and meant it in a, you know, a derogatory way, or, you know, like who's gay at school, those kind of things. I don't think I sang it at football, but I really might have done. And I'm absolutely certain I never said or sang anything racist, right? And I don't know if that's just because, I don't know, I think casual homophobia is still much more acceptable than casual racism is. And I certainly would like to think of myself as an ally. So I don't know if that's just an admission I wanted to make, or just, you know, I can't just sit here and say, oh, I've never called anyone gay when I was 15, you know, as some kind of saint. But like now, what should fans do to help? Because it's quite hard to call it out. It's a hard thing to do.
It's all about education and awareness. And I think the day when we have racism put on the same footing as the LGBT phobia that we hear in stadiums and misogyny that we hear put on the same footing, and people actually calling out in the same way. If you heard someone, and unfortunately at Leicester, we used to get certain towns, certain clubs come and chant the P word, about town full of the P word at Leicester until last decade, you know, just only 15, 16 years ago, it still used to happen. Now you know that anyone around you in a football stadium mostly would call it out. We still saw some horrific racism after England's exit, after England losing the final last year. We've seen some of that re-emerge. But actually, if you heard people chanting racist things, most people would call it out. And you know that. Now, what we want to do is get to the point where people would do the same and have that same value. And I sort of realised that, because in the 70s and 80s, you know, terms would have been used that were racist, that were perfectly part of society. So our job is not just to hector and lecture on with people, but to bring people with us on this journey. And, you know, ultimately, you know, Chris's story about when people see you, ultimately we just remind them that we're as much mad football fans, you know, as crazy about Leicester City or Spurs or whoever as it may be as them. And ultimately that always brings you back to the same level, because once they realize that you're waste too much of your income, spend too much of your time following a football team around Europe, but around the country, they sort of realise actually you're just the same as them. And that's the point we need to get people fans to. But language will always change and will continue to change. You know, there'll be things that we say now around the trans community that even language around that has changed so much. And it's a constant education. But I think the fact for me that's so important is people come to it with good intent. And I'm not going to call out someone who used bad language 15, 20 years ago if they didn't do it intentionally. And it's always hard. Intent's always hard to tell. But actually, you know, Max, I'm not going to call you out and cancel you, because obviously that's not what your intent was. But actually the mission of that helps us move on.
And we don't campaign unless we think that change is possible. Like, we wouldn't be having this conversation if we didn't think that some change was possible.
I'm very certain that as a teenager, I use words in that way as well. Being blunt about it, you know, even sort of, I can look back and say that everyone does things as a teenager that they're mortified by and that they don't think about at the time. And that, you know, definitely. I think, I was reading an interview recently with Josh Cavallo, and he was talking about a teammate in the changing room using the word gay in a way that sort of was offhand. I don't think it was aggressively like offensive, and then suddenly sort of going completely silent and panicking because he was worried, and Josh saying, like, you know, I'm still a human being, we can still laugh, like, and I think that intent matters a lot. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying to say to people it's not helpful, because it isn't helpful that teenagers would use that language, even, because then that means there's teenagers in that space who are feeling uncomfortable, who are struggling to come out more because they're hearing that language. It doesn't mean we shouldn't speak about it and say, hey, this isn't good, but we don't need to put ourselves through the ringer every time for something we did as teenagers. That's not how it works. You know, you need to try and manage your behavior in the future. Manage behavior, that's a horrible way of putting it, because that, again, I don't like using that sort of language, because I think as soon as anyone feels that they're sort of having to tread on, you know, on tiptoes, that's not what you want either. It's just about thinking about why you use language and being more conscious about the impact that words can have.
I had a message from David, said, look, nothing directed at me, but on one occasion, a man stood up in front to abuse the linesman and said, you're a And then a derogatory term for a gay person. It happened after a decision had gone against us. Fans had shouted their disapproval. A second or two after the main hubbub after the decision, he stood up and shouted towards the official. Other occasions have included players being called homophobic slurs for staying down after a challenge or for wearing pink boots. There was an incident away at Arsenal once where homophobic hand gestures were being made between opposition fans, each suggesting the other was gay. I think there's probably been at least one report I've made each season to kick it out about something homophobic or transphobic. And I wonder, Chris, with the, you know, with chanting, are the processes in place, do they work? I.e., you can challenge someone face-to-face. There are risks with challenging anyone face-to-face. You can report it to a steward. You can report it to Kick It Out or to the police. Do you think the system works at the moment?
I think probably the short answer is maybe, but mostly not. Because I think one of the examples I always use is something that Rishi told me, which I'll let him talk to you about, which was like a real-time action in his stadium. I think like more generally with discrimination, I think the problem or discrimination or abuse is, as fans, none of us want to spend half an hour of a 90-minute match that talking to the police or the stewards. And that's what's going to happen if you need to do it properly, right? And so that's problematic. Having said that, you know, reporting it via the text line, which every club's got, and Kick It Out so that we have sort of aggregated, so we can have some numbers and understand what the issues are and what we're dealing with, I think is really, really important. Because you could do it, you know, Kick It Out, you can do it after the event. And also it's difficult, you know, as a season ticket holder, you know, if someone that sits there all the time and then you report them, it's like you could actually make things difficult or more dangerous for yourself. So you've got to make sure that you kind of keep yourself safe. But sort of anonymous reporting via ticket lines or, sorry, the text line or Kick It Out, I think is really, really important. With mass chanting, I mean, that's again, I think that's about trying to sort of change cultures so the mass chanting just doesn't happen. But you'll know that a Spurs fan actually got charged and fined for using the chant we talked about against Chelsea. And, you know, I imagine that he was amongst many, was made an example of. And, you know, I'm not up for criminalising people, but I do think it's important to say, actually, this is against the law. Because, and that's, you know, I think the culture change doesn't come with law, it comes with culture change, but actually having the law underpinning it does help. So I think there's loads of different things there about, yes, report it via Kick It Out, because then we know what really are the issues are that are happening in stadia, so we can figure out how to tackle them. And, you know, some kind of concerted effort across the board, whether it's from LGBTQ plus fan groups in conjunction with their clubs, to try and make that change around saying that chant is a homophobic chant that is not acceptable in football stadia.
Rishi, what's the story that Chris was alluding to?
So it was a Kick It Out focus weekend, actually, and I was actually in another club's ground, and as a result of that, the Kick It Out app and the numbers were better staffed than usual. So it actually meant the report I made real-time at the first half got acted on in the second half, and a steward came and had a word with a young lad who'd been using, quite frankly, racist language in that incident. I think that's the one that Chris is referring to. And it happened at that time, and it wasn't actually painful for me because I did it on the app really quickly. You know, I occasionally tweet during games. I'm used to splurging out nonsense, as most of us are. And it was one of those things where it was really quick to see. However, and this is why Pride and Football gave evidence in the Tracy Crouch family review on this, the data from clubs, the police, and Kick It Out does not come to one place. We don't actually have accurate numbers on this. We get directional trends, and Kick It Out do a great job of giving us directional trends, but there's no real coordination on this, and the football regulator really does need to grasp this so we actually have that right data and then can respond to the specific types and the specific challenges around it. The bit that Chris was referring to about sort of restorative justice, I know Kick It Out and Pride of Irons have done a pilot where it's about talking and meeting fans, and we've done something similar at Fox Pride and Leicester, where you talk to the fans, because 9 times out of 10, you know, it's the odd Neanderthal who's just never going to turn, and they are going to be a bigot, and they can, quite frankly, bugger off from football. Whereas the majority of fans will want, you know, once they realise, most people are mortified And especially actually that's partly a societal shift we've had in the last 20 years where LGBT people are more visible. I mean, part of the reason I go to football for escapism, I don't necessarily want to be doing LGBT stuff every game. I'd love to be as boring a fan sat at the back of the East Stand, say hello if you are ever, you know, just watching the game, shouting at Nacho for missing another great chance. And rather than like doing this, but we're so far from that. And that's where we need to get to. And whether it's flash moments like crowd, you know, chance to come up or individual moments, what I really want is allies and others to pick it up because it's exhausting. I literally want to go and watch football and relax and see my friends and have fun.
Can I ask, actually, when you were, the three you were invited on this podcast, what, if anything, did you think it would achieve? Because I like to think our audience are quite an enlightened bunch, so it's going to be kind of an echo chamber, but there will probably be a proportion of eye rollers who will say we're just ticking a box and being woke and not really, you know, might just fast forward through it or wait for the next one. So, yeah, what are you hoping to achieve, or what are we hoping to achieve indeed?
So happy to go first on this one, because for me, Prime Football, you know, we've got 50 odd fan groups. The magic number is obviously 92. Obviously, it doesn't quite add up that way because we've got Scottish clubs and we include the national associations. But actually, I want every club to have a group. So if your club doesn't have one yet, why don't you ask your club about it? Some of them start fan-led, some of them start red-led by the club. So that would be step one. Step two is just normalization. And like, as I say, I want to be as boring as any other football fan. And I first met Nikki and I in person a couple of years ago. I think it was back pre-pandemic. And the work, Nikki, just by being Nikki, she inspired me to do work with our trans fans, just to normalise and celebrate trans fans. So last year, 2 years ago, sorry, Leicester City, just focused on celebrating our trans fans, just to make it as usual as possible that a trans person could be at the football. We have three of our members who have been featured in that. And if every one of us takes a little bit of this and does a small action, we make football more inclusive for all. And that's why I wanted to be on today.
Yeah, 100%. I think for all the reasons that Rishi's just said, it's like normalising the fact that they're LGBTQ plus people, whether they're in football, whether we're working in football like Nikki is or fans like we are. And also just like having these conversations, because, you know, there's a couple of times when I've just chatted with you, whether it's on the radio or here, Max, and I've had messages from people going, oh, thanks for that. I'd never thought about it like that before. And that's it. You know, I think because, yes, Baz, we are in an echo chamber. But I think the thing is that, you know, what the experience is for us as LGBTQ plus fans or people that just kind of talk about this stuff all the time is kind of a bit different and potentially more nuanced than your average straight or cisgendered fan. And that's not a criticism. It's just that like, they might not hear from the likes of us very often. And I think that's the point. It's like football is for all of us. There might be people out there that are struggling that don't necessarily get to like love football as much as the rest of us. And if we can do some stuff to make that better and you can really be part of it, then I'm really up for that.
I think this is really hard to understand if these are not things that you've ever dealt with in your life, without wanting to sort of make anyone feel bad for that, because you shouldn't feel bad for things you haven't experienced in your life. Everyone's got their own life experience they're on. But when you are LGBT and you have got reasons to think that places might not be welcoming, because we've just talked about some of those reasons, chants do happen, people do say things at stadiums that are offensive. Those sorts of visual acknowledgements that you're welcome can be really important. Like those visual signs that actually know, you know, you're not alone here. They really matter. Like I think because of course it's the end of June, which is Pride Month. And I think there are lots of people who see companies and corporations switching their logos to rainbows and roll their eyes. And listen, no one rolls their eyes at that more than LGBTQ plus people. No one rolls their eyes more than us. But at the same time, sometimes those visual symbols are really important to someone. Sometimes those visual symbols actually are the difference for someone between walking in somewhere and not, is seeing that and thinking, you know what, like, actually, I'm not going to get unsupported here. Like, you can't ever guarantee you're not going to get abused somewhere. I've been abused on my own street before. Like, but you know, you've got people who, at least there's like an acknowledgement there's going to be people there who are on your side. And I think especially with the fan groups, because that's not actually corporate, it's other fans saying, hey, you're welcome here. It's really important.
All right, that'll do for part two. We'll be back in 1 second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. I'm really pleased to say that during the Euros, we are launching the Guardian Women's Football Weekly, which will come out 3 times a week. Holly Faye-Carruthers is your host. She'll be joined on the first episode on Monday by Robin Cowan, Susie Rack, and Johnny Liu. They'll be going throughout the Euros. We'll, of course, be covering it on Football Weekly as well, but you can go to wherever you get your podcasts and listen to the Guardian Women's Football Weekly as well as Football Weekly, and that is brilliant news and not before time. So delighted that that is happening. Back to today's pod on the experiences of the LGBTQ plus community in all aspects of the game. And I want to talk about amateur football because we had loads of messages about people's experiences on Sunday league pitches. Callum says, I was outed at school. I still played in a local five-a-side league. I remember playing other teams with players from my school and would semi-regularly get called gay or see pointing and sniggering about me, which hurt, but was also a huge motivator. Now for an LGBT-friendly team in London, it doesn't seem things have moved on as our first team gets insults thrown at them multiple times a season by, inverted commas, straight teams. Liam says, we regularly receive homophobic abuse in our Sunday league. I've also experienced it when playing six-a-side at leisure leagues. We always report it both to our Sunday league and to leisure leagues, but the response is always disappointing. And Tom says, while I was released from Luton Town simply for not being good enough, I felt I was forced to quit playing football altogether a number of years later as I was homophobically abused in a Sunday league game. I've experienced homophobia in the stands, in the away end at Northampton Town, where fellow Argyle fans were throwing slurs based on the away keeper's pink-coloured kit. The Sunday league game was what I would class as psychological abuse. Opposition players who knew I was gay would take it in turns to whisper crude and offensive things in my ear out of earshots of everyone else. E.g., would you sleep with any of your teammates then, etc. And other similar things. It was a dreadful feeling. I decided after that that I wouldn't put myself through it again for the sake of Sunday morning football. It feels, you know, it's less policed, right, Sunday league football, Chris, than when you're actually at a stadium. You know, there aren't stewards, there aren't police. You know, there isn't a big flag saying you're welcome here. I wonder, you know, like we've said before, it's not just football, it's society. Changing that, is it more important for allies there to call it out on the pitch more so than in a ground? Not that it has to be a competition.
I think let's not make it a competition, but it is really important. And I think the teammates of, you know, the teammates of that gay player, you know, whether if it's an LGBTQ plus team, you know, it's hard. I used to run, back in the early 2000s, I used to run a lesbian women's football team. And, you know, we came out of a game once and our cars had all been scratched. You know, we had like stuff like, you know, we used to play in Hackney Women's Football Club, we used to play in Hackney Marshes. You know, it was a famous lesbian football team. And, you know, people would like write things in the changing rooms and stuff. And it's really hard. But then on the other hand, you go like, but look, to be fair, that doesn't happen to them now. You know, I think that's the other thing, is that it doesn't happen to them now. And actually, even in those days, you'd often get people coming up, you know, players from other teams coming up and going, thanks so much for what you're doing. But like, obviously not being out in their teams. Now, look, we are talking about 20 years ago. It doesn't happen to them now. You know, they're more celebrated and lauded now, I guess, by most. Although sometimes you do get parents, you know, because it's weird, the women's game, right? Like, particularly at kind of grassroots level, you know, this is a bunch of like 20 to 40 year old lesbians playing sometimes against 16 and 17 year olds whose parents are on the sidelines, you know, kind of might having potentially different sort of approaches. And I think what's also challenging in the grassroots game is that we've got a refereeing crisis. You know, so how many times have we all played in a regulated Sunday league game where, you know, I've had to run the line, or you've had to get somebody, literally a passerby who's walking their dog, and said, would you mind holding this bib, and just like, you know, calling the ins and outs of the throw-ins or whatever. And then also, you know, because there's a refereeing crisis, have the referees been trained properly? What happens if you report something to the referee at a grassroots game? Does the referee really know what they're supposed to do? Does the referee understand what LGBTQ plus phobia and what those slurs are? You know, what's going to happen afterwards? It ends up in a in some kind of a tribunal, again, potentially from people that don't know, you know. So there's a systemic thing here that we have to unpick. But then equally, what you've got is our national game, and wonderfully, you know, tens of thousands of people playing every weekend. And so that's why we come back to that stuff around culture change, which is, you know, all of these things that we're doing here, and why, even though if something like Rainbow Laces feels like gesturing, you know, which it could do, there is something about having the you know, the amounts of the millions of people who are watching the Premier League from all over the world and all over the country, as well as the hundreds of thousands in the football stadium that weekend, of what a difference that will make as being part of that culture change.
I think there's something else about that as well, if I can just jump in. Like, I think it's really interesting with Rainbow Laces. Like, I think as a result of Rainbow Laces, several top professional men's footballers have then ended up having conversations publicly about their support, basically. You know, I've heard Rio Ferdinand, Jordan Henderson, like a bunch of players talk very publicly about why inclusion matters and why it sort of is personal to them as well. And I don't think those things happen without the campaign. Like, I just don't think those conversations start. So, you know, again, you know, sometimes I'm certain, well, I think Rishi and Chris agree with me anyway. You know, sometimes I look at you like, oh God, there's a defence contractor on Twitter with its rainbow flag. Great. You know, like, but actually, like, in football, I think it's been really important.
Like, you talked about Josh Cavallo, you know, plays in the A-League and who came out. And then Jake Daniels obviously came out recently in the UK. I always wonder, Rishi, if we just, you know, like, it's still rare, so it becomes a news story, and then everybody gets sort of incredibly excited about it. And I feel there's so much weight put on it. But I wonder, is it similar to like the Rainbow Laces campaign? It does actually matter, even if it's frustrating and it shouldn't matter, that it actually still does matter, that now players, current players, are feeling comfortable enough to come out.
Yeah, the Rainbow Laces campaign, it's amazing watching it evolve and develop. I mean, both Chris and I will be cynical about it at various stages. I mean, given its founding and where it originally even came from, we know that there was, you know, there's been aspects of it. However, we can't deny it's made a difference, because getting all the Premier League clubs and now increasingly all Football League clubs to do stuff around those certain days, and we still don't know when they're going to be this year because the Qatar World Cups are in the middle of when Rainbow Laces normally would be. But it all adds to that climate. So you're not going to change stuff at grassroots football unless you change at top level football. And the fact that Jake was 30 years since the last male footballer came out, and that ended so tragically, and it still moves me to think about that. Like, Jake was phenomenal for a 17-year-old. Incredible. What authenticity. If anyone, any listener, has not heard the interview, please, where you've been hiding under a rock, but please do, because it's just incredible to hear a young man speak like that, who hopefully will encourage others. And that's where we need to get to. But we need to change our culture first. So we've talked about the fans, booing and things at grounds. And all these things will slowly ladder up. We will get there. But I think these campaigns are still essential for now, because otherwise it wouldn't get talked about. It just, you know, it'd just be another silent thing.
You mentioned Qatar. Homosexuality is illegal there. It's obviously hosting the World Cup, as you say, during the month when the Rainbow Laces campaign would be. You sort of feel they should just do it then anyway. You know, the England players should be wearing Rainbow Laces for sure. I just wonder how, like, personally, Chris, are you going to watch? I don't know how massive an England fan you are, but maybe that's not the point. You must love the World Cup. Who doesn't love the World Cup? Like, how do you feel about it happening there?
It pains me. It pains me to have seen the last World Cup in Russia, and now look, frankly, and to see it in Qatar. And, you know, I think what's really important is that we don't get kind of caught up in Islamophobia, right? And I've spoken to several LGBTQ plus campaigners from the Middle East, you know, who talk about the fact that this is about an oppressive regime, not about Islam, you know. And look, we know we're not perfect here. We've got this conversion therapy ban that doesn't include trans people, which is like unacceptable. We've got all the stuff that we see that happens on social media. We've seen increases in hate crime, but we are going to hold a World Cup and celebrate the festival of football in a place where the LGBTQ plus community live in fear of their lives, where they're often, where they can be entrapped by the state, where the state, you know, where we have oppression of, you know, we have oppression of women. We've seen what's happened with workers' rights. And, you know, it's not about saying, oh, can I hold hands with my partner if I'm LGBTQ plus and I go there and someone says, well, you know, it's not, you know, even if you're heterosexual, you know, public displays of affection are not cultural norms. That's totally fine. It's not about me trying to go and hold hands with somebody. But like, have we, you know, we've got this Qatar working group that Kick It Out, actually. I'll tell you a little bit about that. It includes people from Stonewall, the FSA, Football vs. Homophobia, Sports Media, LGBT, Inside Inclusion. And we came up with three objectives. One is a safe and inclusive World Cup for LGBTQ plus fans and anyone who's working at the tournament. You know, and we saw Magda Eriksson talked at the back end of last year, I think, saying she wouldn't feel safe going as a lesbian woman. But she wanted to sort of speak out for those who have got no voice, whether they're the workers or the LGBTQ plus community. The second objective we have is a positive legacy for LGBTQ plus Qataris, whatever that looks like. And I think the point that you're making there is like, what can we do? It's like, will I watch the World Cup? Yes, probably. Will I go to the World Cup? No. But, you know, if you listen to, you know, there's one out LGBTQ plus Qatari, and I urge you all to follow him on social media. Dr. Nas Mohammed came out recently. It was a big story on the BBC. There have been stories about him with his, you know, including his story in Germany and Denmark recently. He's taken, he's sought asylum in the United States, which is where he is now. And, you know, he talks about his experience. And the thing that he says is, look, talk about it. Talk about what's happening to LGBTQ plus Qataris. You know, Harry Kane used the words about shining a light on those stories. And it's really important because that's the one thing that we can do, right? Is to say, actually, there are some stories here and we can have open that conversation about what's going on in Qatar along on all of those things, you know, potentially in the region, but also here. Because I think that's the thing is like, I don't want us to sort of enable Islamophobia or some kind of like that sort of small-minded like doesn't happen here, because you know what, stuff does. And then the third thing in this working group is creating some kind of an LGBTQ plus voice within sports leadership to inform key decisions around future events. And another thing that Magda Eriksson talked about was better transparency from FIFA.
Good luck with that. I know,
right? But like, this is the thing, we don't want to see this again. I really don't want to be having this conversation again.
Nikki, have you, I mean, I know Italy haven't qualified, which might sort of dent the amount of work you'd be asked to do for this World Cup. But like, has it affected how you think you will cover it or what work you will do on it?
I mean, certainly Italy not qualifying has simplified certain things because I wasn't sure, like, if Italy qualify and they're going there as European champions, am I trying to get out there? Like, am I trying to cover the tournament from Qatar? What does that look like, right? Because I was seeking some of these answers out and I never had a satisfactory answer to it so far, which seems to have been the default response that I've heard. The default response that I've heard to, oh, is it safe for LGBTQ plus fans to travel to Qatar is, well, look, it's a very reserved society. Even straight couples don't show public displays of affection. So as long as you just don't do that, everything's going to be all right. Well, what do you want me to do? Right? I'm trans. That's just literally who I am. It's not me holding hands with someone. And by the way, you know, being gay is also not holding hands with someone. It's not kissing someone. It's also who you are. But I understand that people might conceptualize this as something that you could make less visual. What am I going to do? Like, am I going to wear a big cardboard box as I shuffle around town so that no one can see me? Like, you know, it's ridiculous. And there's been nothing, there's been no comment that I've seen publicly about, oh yeah, no, it's, you know, we're going to make sure that people are safe. So, you know, yes, in lots of ways, Italy not qualifying has made that more straightforward for me personally, but it doesn't answer the question at all. I find this whole topic really, really difficult, honestly, because LGBTQ plus issues are obviously hugely important to me, but that's not the only reason that I'm furious that there's a World Cup in Qatar. There's, you know, human rights abuses in the way that these stadiums have been built. It's going to be an extremely uncomfortable tournament to watch and follow, let alone to cover. The juxtaposition of football with what has happened to make that tournament happen is just deeply, deeply uncomfortable for me. And I haven't resolved all of how I think about what I'm going to do with work around that tournament, to be honest with you. It's I think the whole situation is just gross.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. It's something that we are wrestling with, working out how to cover it on the pod. We sort of run out of time on this pod. It always feels sort of trite, Rishi, to say, look, if there's one thing people can do, because obviously there's lots of people can do, and we've touched on those things. But if there's one thing people can do, who are listening to this, who just, want football to be as inclusive as it possibly can be, like what would you? I'll ask that to everybody as a way to finish. Mainly because I haven't thought of a better way of ending the pod.
So who follow a club or a national side, join their LGBT fan group as an ally, support that the work of our groups. We've got 50 plus now, and hopefully we'll get to 92. If your club doesn't have one, support that when it launches. But just inform yourself about the issues. Actually, ultimately, it's for people to help. The way we tackle this is through education, and also, yeah, come along to our things. Our things are fun as well. Rainbow Laces, Football versus Home Phobia. We do cool things. So do come along and join us.
I would also encourage people to follow Dr. Anas Mohammed on all social media and sign his petition. So he's got an all-out petition that I think is called Love is Love. I can link to it when we tweet out this pod or whatever. Sign the petition. It'd be great to get more signatures on it.
I think both Rishi and Chris have already covered some really important bases. Just be vocal, be supportive in a vocal way when you hear things that aren't right. Challenge them. Be someone who actually speaks their mind, because it's not easier to challenge things just because we are LGBTQ+. In fact, it's often harder, because when you speak up against something, you think to yourself, is anyone going to back me up here? Am I going to be the only person? Am I going to be even more isolated because of this? If you are in an environment and you think you're with people who you think, oh, that's, so-and-so is a good person. I've never sort of had any problems with them. And then they say something that you think, well, hang on, that's not great. Say it to them, right? Because actually the person who they think of as a friend is going to be more willing to listen to them actually than a stranger saying it. So yeah, speak up, be vocal.
All right. Thanks everybody. Was that worth doing, Baz?
Yeah, I thought it was a very worthwhile endeavor.
Excellent. Look, Nikki, thank you so much for getting up incredibly early in the United States to do this pod.
Do you know what the worst part of doing this so early in the morning was? This is the most, we've gone from real problems to the most first world of first world problems, is that I'm in America, and so the hotel room I'm in doesn't have tea. So I had to go out at 5:30 in the morning to find a tea, because I was not going to do this without a tea, but I did find one.
Proper tea. Builder's tea.
Yeah, I mean it's crap tea because it's America, but it's tea.
Well, I'm glad you got that. Fueled you through the pods.
Sorry, I've just made a sweeping generalization about America.
No, you're absolutely right. This pod has an anti-US agenda. We've been very clear about it ever since we didn't mention that Christian Pulisic goal. It's good to carry it on. Rishi, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks, Chris.
Thanks, guys. And I'll see you at the Hackney Empire, chaps, on the 9th.
Can you bring 250 mates?
Get the football team together.
Cheers, Chris. That'll do for today. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.